Welcome to the show. Welcome to National Google Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, republicbroadcasting.org. Also, nationalbugle.com. Check out National Bugle Radio on nationalbugle.com. Okay, today is Thursday, and I am expecting Don Advo to be joining me in just a little while. And we take calls. Don likes to take calls, so that number is 1-800-313-9443. 1-800-313-9443. Before we get Don on with us, I just want to bring up a few things. There's some things that you can check out on nationalbugle.com and also on davidduke.com. One thing here, this was from Mark Colette's Twitter feed. Tinder, for those of you who don't know, Tinder is one of these social networking apps. I think it helps young people, or maybe not so young people, find dates and hook up. Tinder says it's really into interracial love. They show a picture of a stylishly groomed white man drinking coffee with his arm around an attractive African-American woman with a lot of tattoos on her arm, by the way. That's the picture. And there was an article in a survey published Tuesday by the dating app Tinder. People who date online and on Tinder specifically say such services make them more open-minded about dating someone outside their own race or ethnicity. Now, on Mark's Twitter feed, he says, he says, Tinder says it's really into interracial love and helps users date outside of their race. It's almost like there's an agenda, .. Who could it be? What could it be? Well, here, this is from the Jewish Journal. Meet the Jewish founders of Tinder. Okay, and they talk about the Jewish founders. They talk about three, but there's a Sean Rad, who is the, I believe he's the CEO, and Justin Mateen is the chairman of the board. Is that how it works? I'll get that in just a second. But they're two Jewish 27-year-olds from Los Angeles. Wow. Okay, so yes, Sean Rad is the CEO, and Justin Mateen is the chief marketing officer. It's almost like there is an agenda. I mean, personally, I think who you share your life with is a personal decision. It's something that, whether you're looking at Romeo and Juliet or whatever, people make their own decisions about these things, and in the end, it's their decision. But it's not as if society doesn't have a stake in it as well. It's not as if society shouldn't have a right to make its preferences known. Now, obviously, in Israeli society, they've made a preference known that, and inside Israel, if you're a Jew, you cannot marry a non-Jew. You can go overseas and get married and come back, okay, but the preference has been known. In the United States, no, you're not allowed, the society can't make a preference, but these Jews in the media, in academia, in the corporate world, they make their preferences known, and it's interesting that these Jews at Tinder have made their preference known, that they're really into interracial dating. I wonder if they're really into it in Israel. I wonder what their Israeli operations are like. That would be interesting to find out. So, what else is going on? Just checking. Do we have Don Advo's not with us yet? I hope he joins us, but we'll see. We were talking earlier today on Stormfront Radio, and one of the things we were talking about on Stormfront was Kevin MacDonald. Kevin MacDonald, back in the 1990s, wrote three books. Three books on Jews. He wrote the A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy. He wrote, that was published 1994, he wrote Separation and Its Discontents, Towards an Evolutionary Theory of Anti-Semitism, published 1988, and then, I hope these dates are right, finally, The Culture of Critique, An Evolutionary Analysis of Jewish Involvement in 20th Century Intellectual and Political Movements. This was his trilogy. And, you know, people, they're long books, and I can't say that I've read all three of them from cover to cover. I do have all three of them, and I've read large parts of them. Academic reading is tough. If you're taking a class and it's required reading for the class, you push yourself through. This was never required reading for any class I took, though. Oh, we do have Don Advo trying to join us. Let's get him in here just a second. Mr. T, do you think you could try to pull Don Advo in? Because he is trying to call me right now. Okay, well, he just tried to call me in.
And hello.
So he is around. But at any rate, the first book really wasn't that critical of Jews, but it was talking, and it was talking about them as having a different evolutionary, different evolutionary path and evolutionary strategy. Don, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Yeah, I started the show talking about the dating / hookup app Tinder. We can go back to that in a little bit, but just now I was introducing the Culture of Critique. Well, Kevin MacDonald and his trilogy, culminating in the Culture of Critique, which was published in 1998, 20 years ago, and for 20 years it had never been. It had never had a academic review, much to Kevin MacDonald's chagrin, because this is what academics want. They want their work to be talked about, to be debated. And he had this work that by the time we got to the Culture of Critique, he had himself become increasingly critical of Jews. It's funny because he started off just picking Jews. He had this idea of group behavior and group evolutionary strategy. And, you know, he could have looked at the Amish. He could have looked at, maybe the Lebanese in Africa or the Chinese overseas community. There's a lot of people he could have looked at. He could have looked at gypsies. And he picked Jews, not because he had any animosity towards them, but because there's a lot of material there, and it would lend itself to a good academic study. But oddly enough, the more he studied Jews, the more critical he became of them. And so, in the Culture of Critique, he specifically dealt with these several intellectual movements, and demonstrated how they were hostile to the culture of the United States, and B, how they were designed at recreating society in the interests of the Jews. You brought this up this morning on Stormfront, and a month ago or so, a young Jewish academic in Britain finally got around to reviewing this book, a book that had been dismissed by major Jewish academics like Steven Pinker, had been dismissed as not being worth reading, not being worth reviewing. But finally somebody's reviewed it, and that provided Professor McDonald with a chance to have a rebuttal to the review. So, what do you think of this? The culture of critique has just been gaining a higher and higher profile over the past couple of years, don't you think?
Well, it certainly appears to have been. That was what he said. Kevin McDonald was interviewed by Luke Ford on Luke Ford's YouTube channel, and he said he thought that was the reason. They largely ignored it, and it, unfortunately for them, it didn't go away. It became more and more influential, and now the time has come when they can't really afford to overlook it anymore. So now there's official academic interest in it, and it's been reviewed, and of course the review was kind of patronizing and very unflattering, saying it was, you know, poor scholarship and it ignored this and ignored that, and not every Jew acts in concert and not every Jew has the same conception of Jewish interests, which of course
that he didn't make in the first place, right?
Quite correct. Absolutely correct.
And this trilogy of books, he started writing them because he was a psychologist, professor of psychology, and he had ideas and theories about group evolutionary strategy as he thought it applied to humans. He wanted to apply this to humans, and that was what he started. I mean, that was what he was intentionally, his original intention was to, test his theories on group evolutionary strategy. But the real significance of the books, and especially this third book, Culture of Critique, its real significance isn't proving a theory of group evolutionary strategy. That's not really its significance. Its significance is its demonstration of Jews as a hostile ruling elite that is trying to destroy the culture and, in fact, the very people, the very DNA of the host populations in the United States is really what he's dealing with, and replacing it with a different culture and, frankly, a different people. I mean, he was mostly talking about the culture in the Culture of Critique. What's transpired in the subsequent 20 years has led him to talk about the DNA of the people as well. And I think that's the real significance. And any points that they might be able to make about group evolutionary strategy really misses the significance of the book. Don't you think so?
Yeah, I sure do. I sure do think it misses the significance of the book. The book is, I think it's about 500 pages. It's very, very intense, very well written, very well researched, very extensively documented. And he discusses the Jewish role in various revolutionary movements throughout the 20th century. So it's an extremely I flipped through it, and it's very, very intense. It's very well written, and a huge arsenal of intellectual ammunition, but also more than that, it's very historically intense. And of course, Jewish evolutionary theory is an historic theory. McDonald conceded, or at least made the point, he did not believe it had predictive value because it is historic, and through the course of evolution, changes occur as a matter of course. And he did talk about one of the things within the Jewish world is increasing dissent, increasing challenges of the Jewish state of Israel by other Jews, and also the problem of marriage outside the Jewish group. Now, isn't it interesting that Jews are allowed to address out marriage as a problem, as something that undermines their separate and distinct racial existence, but white people are not? White people aren't even allowed to make the argument, because it seems like to even suggest that whites have separate and distinct racial interests is itself a form of racism, is itself a form of hate speech. Yet Jews openly are allowed to proclaim their own separate and distinct racial interests and to work to advocate them and to work in favor of achieving them. So the contrast, it seems to me that one cannot help but ignore the contrast between the way the chosen people treat themselves and the way they treat white people.
Indeed. There's just such a double standard there. Now, Kevin MacDonald's book, This Culture of Critique, it talks about, I've got it in front of me, he's got Chapter 1, Jews and the Radical Critique of Gentile Culture. That's Introduction to Theory. Then he goes into these specific movements, talks about the Boasian School, Jews and the Left, Jewish involvement in the psychoanalytic movement, the Frankfurt School of Social Research, and the pathologization of Gentile group allegiances, Jewish criticism of Gentile culture, and then Chapter 7, which is really, really significant, Jewish involvement in shaping U.S. immigration policy. Now, there's 64 pages in my paperback edition, 64 pages of that. And it really lays out the case that this 1965 Immigration Act was a product of Jewish activism. It simply would not have happened without Jewish activism. There wasn't a big groundswell of pro-open borders sentiment among the people of the United States in the 1960s. Not amongst the whites, not amongst the blacks, and there wasn't a whole lot of other people here besides whites and blacks in 1960. This was a Jewish project. And as an adjunct to that Chapter 7, I always refer to a much, much shorter book by Senator Eugene McCarthy from Minnesota, who's best known for his challenge to President Johnson in the 1968 Democratic primaries, where he effectively knocked Johnson out of the race and out of the White House. He was a co-sponsor of the 1965 Immigration Act, but in 1992 wrote a book, Colony of the World, the United States Today. I often get those, I transpose that the title and the subtitle, but it's A Colony of the World, the United States Today. And in his Chapter 4 on borders, this is a short chapter, we're talking about 14 pages. Well, we'll get into that after the break.
There's an ongoing war right here in America. Are you aware that U.S. citizens have been classified as enemies of the state since 1933? Have you recognized that our entire government is really a vast network of interlocking corporations engaged in commerce? Look up Title 28, Section 3002. Tune in to In Defense of Humanity on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Central Time. Find out what's really going on. and learn how to protect yourself and your family as flesh and blood men and women living in a corporate reality. There is an ongoing war right here in America. Are you aware that U.S. citizens have been classified as enemies of the state since 1933? Have you recognized that our entire government is really a vast network of interlocking corporations engaged in commerce? Look up Title 28, Section 3002. Tune in to In Defense of Humanity on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Central Time. Find out what's really going on and learn how to protect yourself and your family as flesh and blood men and women living in a corporate reality.
Tired of being lied to by mass media? It's growing more and more apparent today that news is received less and less through standard media outlets. Even with a growing audience every day, RBN is beginning to direct more efforts into social media. Social media and the use of the internet is fast becoming the primary source of people for news, regardless of demographic. RBN has set out to provide some of the best news on the internet through republicbroadcasting.org and also has begun to use the tools to our advantage by way of social media. Republic Broadcasting is now operating a Facebook page to function as yet another avenue to have our collective voice reach new audiences across not only America, but across the globe as well. The Facebook page features not only news, but also an RBN player to listen to our broadcast. Get involved by visiting facebook.com/republicbroadcasting and liking our page and share it with your friends and family, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the show. Welcome back. So just before the break, this is Patrick Slattery with Don Advo on National Bugle Radio on RBN. And just before the break, we were been talking about the culture of critique and Chapter 7 on immigration, the Jewish role in immigration. And then I was referring to Senator Eugene McCarthy's work not long before he passed away, A Colony of the World, the United States Today, and in Chapter 4 on borders. It's a short chapter, and it's just a few pages. He doesn't mention Jews at all. He mentions Jewish names, but doesn't identify them as Jews. But it's kind of a mea culpa. Why did he support this act in 1965? Support, co-sponsor. Why did he co-sponsor this act in 1965 that here in 1992 he is saying has been a complete disaster? And this is on what this chapter does very well is it shows the duplicity. It shows that the Congress was deceived, that this was specifically, this law was specifically designed to deceive Congress into thinking that, oh, they were just going to bring the immigration law up to date to remove the to remove a racist facade, racist language, but that it really wasn't going to change the demographics of the United States. And of course it did. And if you were to look at what happened afterwards, you'd also see heavy Jewish involvement. And it's through refugees. And who's always pushing refugees? I mean, who's always pushing that we need to accept refugees? And it's also through the diversity lottery of Chuckie Schumer that he introduced. The 1965 Immigration Act centers around, 75% of the people who enter the United States legally are coming through family unification. Family unification was specifically sold to the Congress, as a way of maintaining the demographic status quo, because who could have family connections to the United States? I mean, if there aren't Somalis living in the United States, there's no Somali connections to the United States, right?
Absolutely right.
Right? But once you start bringing in Somali refugees, now you've planted the seeds. So you started plant with all of these wars and creating all of these refugees, you plant the seeds. And of course, family reunification means you have to have family relations. And when you start bringing in people from high birth rate areas, where, you know, a Somali mother is typically going to have 6 or 7 children. Even if you were to say, oh, yeah, well, you got Irish immigration. Yeah, but the Irish don't have many, at least nowadays, Irish don't have many children. So they don't have brothers or sisters to bring in, whereas the Somalis and the El Salvadorians do. And so this planting seeds and the diversity lottery was specifically aimed at planting seeds from countries which didn't already have seeds planted. That's the whole thing. The top 12 or 13 countries supplying immigration to the United States are excluded from the diversity lottery. So it means you get more and more and more countries with seeds planted in the United States, and they can start bringing in their brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and cousins. And of course, Don Advo, do you have any brothers or sisters overseas that you would like to help immigrate to the United States?
No, I don't.
Any uncles or aunts or first cousins?
No, okay. Absolutely not.
So, but your Mexican neighbors in Mexican-occupied California do. Who's got the first-class citizenship? Who's in control of immigration policy? According to Senator McCarthy, this put immigrants in control of immigration policy.
Oh, that's an interesting that is a really interesting statement. That is a really interesting observation. God, immigrants in control of immigration policy.
Yeah,
God,
because all they have to do is apply for a visa. It's they who sponsor these people, the legal immigrants. 70 to 75% of legal immigrants come over through family unification, and so it is these immigrants themselves who don't even need to have citizenship yet. They just need to have a green card, and they're in control of 70% or more of immigration, legal immigration into the United States.
Wow.
And Donald Trump knows this, and so this is why Donald Trump is trying to end the family reunification aspect of immigration law, and this is why the Jews are pushing back at him so hard.
Well, I hope you're right about that.
Okay, I think we're coming up on our next break, but we will be back with more from Don Advo on Catholic Radio.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to aroutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech. Quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AirOutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AirOutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. plus magful clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to aroutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at aroutfitting.com.
Do you know there is an ongoing war right here in America? Are you aware that U.S. citizens have been classified as enemies of the state since 1933? Have you recognized that our entire government is really a vast network of interlocking corporations engaged in commerce? Look up Title 28, Section 3002. Tune in to In Defense of Humanity on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Central Time. Find out what's really going on and learn how to protect yourself and your family as flesh and blood men and women living in a corporate reality.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2, keep it today.
And welcome back to the show, National Bugle Radio, with Patrick Slattery and Don Advo. And Don, you were asking a question just while we were on break.
Yeah. Here's the issue. I've heard this analysis made several times over the years, many times, is that Jews make up a tiny percent of the population, even though they exercise control over many levers of power. But they work at about 99% efficiency to maintain power, while we work at, 5% of our potential to challenge Jewish power very feebly and, for the most part, very ineffectively. And the theory is that, it doesn't take a huge amount of organized opposition to Jewish power because it is their grip on it is so fragile. And I wonder, because there are so many more of us than there are of them, in part. Now, my question to you is, do you believe that analysis is correct? And second, what do you think, if so, what do you think is their most vulnerable point?
Yeah, the question has a lot in it. It's more than just a question. There's a premise there, and I think there's a lot to be said to that. That Jews are working highly efficiently. It's not that they have more resources, but that they're able to mobilize those resources. And maybe an analogy would be if you ever did camping and tried to start a campfire. You have to have the fuel, but you have to have the combustible materials close enough to each other and with enough oxygen moving in, enough ventilation, that the fire can spread from, one twig to another, from one branch to another, in order for the fire to get going. Which, you know, if, and in that analogy, Jews are able to communicate with each other, and they're able to talk relatively openly to each other. They have all these channels for communications. They've got their synagogues, they've got their organizations, they've got their, you know, For Jews press, although we do have some a certain amount of access to that to see what they're saying. But even if we can see what they're saying, we're not allowed to talk on our own behalf to each other. We can't talk about our issues. And so the analogy would be we're a bunch of twigs and branches and logs that are just kind of spread all over the place and with no wind. And, you can't start a fire that way. We have to get close to each other, and we've got to have the lines of communication open. And the reason that the Jewish power structure is reacting really so violently and draconianly against the alt-right or the patriot movement, people like us, is that, yes, we're kind of like the wind that is helping the spread of ideas. As long as there's no communication between us, and you know, they do, with their effective domination of the media, they're able to clamp down on our communication. They're able to clamp down on our funding of each other. That's how they maintain power. And so I think the premise of the question is largely correct, that they work efficiently and we don't. And I think the reason we don't work efficiently is because we're not our ability to communicate with each other is so hampered by their domination of media and finance. And the finance is important because it means that it's very difficult to do this work on a full-time basis. And, you know, when you can't work on a full-time basis, you can't create a culture of critique, for instance. Kevin McDonald was able to work full-time on it because he already had tenure. They gave him tenure before they knew what was going to happen, probably before he knew what he was going to do. In fact, I know it was before he knew what he was going to do. Whereas they have tons and tons of people who can work full-time pushing their ethnic agenda. And in fact, they like to bring in these people at very young ages so that they can become very, you know, have prominent careers spanning decades. Yeah. So you asked the question. What do you think of the question?
I think their power is fragile, and I think that's why they work so hard immediately to suppress just about any kind of challenge that comes up. One thing I noticed when I was involved in certain conservative organizations here in Southern California is that there seemed to be Jews there whose function it was to police things and keep the organizations from talking about certain issues. I used to go to a lot of Republican meetings, and I would ask questions. I would ask the speaker, do you believe, typically a candidate for public office or something, and I would say, do you believe the Jewish state of Israel has a right to exist? And, of course, we all know the answer to that. Kind of like Pavlovian type of response, of course, yes, you know. And then I would say, do you believe America has a right to exist? And there was kind of a hush that would come over the room. And eventually I was asked not to come back. They made it known I was not welcome in their groups. And then I was involved. And you go onto anti-immigration websites and some conservative websites, and they're very sensitive to any criticism of Jews. So they try to snuff out. It's like a flicker. It's like a match in the wind. You know, you light a match in a strong wind, and it's very difficult to keep that match from being blown out. So I think they do have a tenuous hold on power, and I think they realize that the backlash could come very quickly if it were allowed to gain momentum. Now, the next question is, what is their vulnerability? Is there a shorter distance between two points than we have been able to find it? And of course, I think this raises another question. What is the Jewish chain of command? Who Is there a Jewish chain of command? I mean, they have all these organizations, the World Jewish Congress, the Jewish Association of Presidents of Jewish Associations. I think it's the ADL that really exercises a lot of power within the United States. I think it functions as a kind of as an arm of the Jewish State of Israel, an unregistered foreign agent of the Jew, or an unregistered agent of a foreign power. But what do you think about the chain of command?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's not a Jewish chain of command. And I think that is one of the things that makes them strong. That if there were a Jewish chain of command, you could attack the head of the chain of command, right?
Right.
I think that there's not a Jewish chain of command. You have the, the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, you know, 50 heads of these major Jewish organizations they meet. Is that the Central Organization for Jews? No, I don't think so. You have the Israeli government. That's completely separate from the Conference of Presidents. You have the Rothschild banking family and its other major Jewish banks. How does the media play into it? The media is, these Jews in the media, are they subjected to Israeli rule? Are they not members of the Council of Presidents? There would be a certain amount of financial leverage over them, but I don't think it's centralized. I think it's decentralized. And I think one of the problems that we have is that it's much easier to conceptualize a centralized organization like the military. It's much easier to, or a government. And I think that's not what we're dealing with. And so people like to, it's easier to think about a centralized chain of command, but I don't think that's what we're dealing with. What do you think?
Well, they have their enforcement arms, and they have their litigation arms. They have their finance arms, and they have their propaganda, information such as the media and Hollywood. I think they kind of work in concert. I think there's some people who promulgate policy and others who go ahead and support it.
Mm-hmm.
That's one problem I've had in studying the whole Jewish issue, is that it's hard to figure out who's really in command. I think that one thing I do think is that money is extremely important,
mm-hmm.
in money financing, because if you don't get financing, that blows everything else out. But then,
right.
The thing that's really huge that we have to deal with is enforcement. Enforcement is really a major problem when you've got the SPLC and you've got these various organizations. Their litigation is extremely powerful, but then they've got a huge presence in the judicial system. It is a very, very vexing problem. It's almost like a form of spontaneous, it's almost as though there's mental telepathy that goes on between them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it really is. They all seem to have a very strong understanding of their group interests, and they seem to follow along rather spontaneously. I don't see it like the, the Sopranos or the Mafia or something like that, where there's a chain of command. Although, in considering Jewish criminality, I read a couple of books about Jewish history, and Jews are not embarrassed by the Jewish crime syndicates. It's almost as though they regard them as just kind of mm-hmm. an important inherent part of the Jewish milieu. It's like, oh well, that's everybody else has their crime syndicates, and these are ours. So, You know, how I mean, they could shut down the crime syndicate, and that would still leave Wall Street and Hollywood and the mainstream media very much in power. And of course, you have the academics. I mean, the academics. We didn't talk about that. They've got a kind of a world under themselves.
Right. Very important.
Well, if you think of the second half of the 20th century, there was a struggle between two economic systems. You had central planning, Soviet-style central planning, that was in the communist world, and then you had market economics, whatever you take that to mean, in the rest of the world. And central planning, you had a chain of command. You had a central planner. These bureaucracies at the government would come up with central plans, and they would dictate to the companies how much you're going to buy, where you're going to buy from, how much you're going to produce. It was centrally planned. In Western economies, you didn't have that kind of central planning. Did everything work the way Adam Smith would have idealized? No. But you didn't have a central chain of command the way you did in the Soviet Union. And which wound up being more efficient? Which wound up working better? And so, again, getting back to the Jewish chain of command, I think it works. What they're doing works. It doesn't require a central chain of command. Telepathy, they have telepathy in that it is so wide, because of the ethnocentrism that Kevin MacDonald bases his theories on, because of the high level of ethnocentrism in the Jewish community, which may have a genetic basis to it, certainly has cultural basis to it, they are much more likely than others to ask, what's good for our group? What's good for the Jews? And, you know, I have a headline on nationalbugle.com right now, Pompeo, is he good for the Jews? It's something like that. And I think that substitutes for the telepathy. They're asking the same question, is it good for the Jews? They don't all come up with the same answers, but there's enough commonality among the answers that they can function as an entity. We have a call from William from Montana. William, welcome to the conversation.
Good morning.
William, are you there?
Don and Patrick, glad to see you back, Don.
Thank you.
Jews, I was reading just last night a group of, ambassadors back in 1918, 1917. You know, one was the United States ambassador to Russia. Another one was the Netherlands ambassador to Russia. And they all wrote communiques back, and they said, you know, this Bolshevik revolution really needs to be nipped in the bud, or it's going to spread in one form or another all over Europe. And the principal group, you know, pushing this was this Jewish contingent that is almost flies under the radar, because no one would expect someone with such a small percentage to have such a large impact. And one of the communiques from the Netherlands, the ambassador, he said, you know, the Jews have a great advantage in not having a nationality, you know. And it says, you know, the problem with us, you know, facing off on this is that we all come from different nationalities, and we have specific interests for our own nations. And this is the thing that Patrick was talking about, why the embers don't communicate, why the fire doesn't spread more rapidly, is that here we have a group of nationalities that are always thinking about their own interest, where the Jews really don't have this nationality. And even one of their own commentators back during that same time, they said, you know, the power that we have, the the power of the Bolshevik Revolution, this was a leader in the American Jewish community in 1920, says was largely the product of Jewish thinking, Jewish discontent, and Jewish effort to reconstruct the world in their own image. And it said, you know, this is the power, you know, this is what speaks to, you know, Patrick's thing about, you know, it doesn't need to have a chain of command, and also Don's point about, you know, is there some type of mental telepathy at work here?
Okay.
Yep.
That we'll be back after break.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2 keep it today.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship.
Welcome back to the show, the last segment of National Bugle. And William, you were just posing a question.
Well, and to expand upon your suggestion that their power is in how they work as a distributed network, you know, it's just like the power of the Internet. All you have to do is have an agreed-upon protocol, you know, and then each node, you know, sort of magically, almost clairvoyantly, works in Congress with each other, you know, not because of instructions, but because they share this protocol.
Oh, very interesting. Very interesting. I sometimes think of it in terms of an antitrust kind of analysis, antitrust law, where people with common economic interests act in unison, and sometimes they do it without having to have much in the way of an express agreement. They just kind of intuitively understand what their interests are, and they go from there. And people who have practiced in that area have used that kind of implied interest and that sort of an analysis. Maybe that's the model we need to be looking at.
Very good point. I'm always happy when you bring in your legal expertise because, you know, when it comes down to it, that legal aspect is very important to understand.
Well, you see, in terms of antitrust law, it doesn't take an express agreement to prove a conspiracy. It only takes an implied. A conspiracy can be inferred from conduct. And so you have people get together at trade organizations. I guess the National Steel Manufacturers Convention or whatever, and they wink and nod and do things very informally and just on kind of the basis that they know what their interests are, and it only takes. And then when you study price moves and allocations and things like that within the industry, that's all they really need. They don't need. They don't need much more than that. So,
pro bono.
Yeah. Maybe we don't have to worry so much about why they do what they do. It's just that we know what they do. That's the important thing. I mean, we don't have to, why does the rattlesnake bite us? We only have to know that if it does, we're pretty much goners. So
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Are there high profile cases that we might know about where this type of implied, collusion or agreement was enough to warrant court action?
Well, all of the antitrust area. I can't think of any specific cases off the top of my head, but these are arguments that are made. These are arguments that are made in every conspiracy theory case, even outside of specifically antitrust law. So it's kind of like if people act in concert, even in the absence, an agreement can be inferred. You don't have to find a signed or written agreement or even a confession of an oral agreement. That you just have to look at certain acts and look at the consequence, who benefits from these acts.
And yet so often you do hear people talking about signed agreements, secret laws, secret governments, which, I mean, there's stuff that goes on in secret. But is that the bulk of it? Well, that will have to be discussed for another day. Maybe can you come back again soon, Don Avro? Thank you. I hope so. Thank you. And until tomorrow, stay tuned for another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.